This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. In 1913, National Geographic published the first photographs taken with an automatic camera trap. A wildlife photographer rigged a string to his camera shutter and used bait to get the animals to pull the string. Arguably, those were the first animal selfies ever. Things have changed since then. Technology's come a long way, and more scientists are using camera traps to study behavior and diversity of species all over the world. It's also opened a new frontier for citizen science. Biologist Roland Kays has documented this evolution of camera traps in a new book called Candid Creatures. It includes more than 600 photos of animals we know well and others that have been rarely studied. Roland Kays is the director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences and joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome back, Roland. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Give us an idea of how things have changed since 1913 when they did the first those first camera traps.
Well, imagine any camera back then. To get a picture of anything other than in bright daylight, you needed flashes, which were these cakes of magnesium powder. And so there are these pictures of Frank Chapman's setup, rig up in the rainforest in Panama with two giant cakes of magnesium powder. And he said when those would go off, it would be like a cannon. And unfortunately, we only have the picture of the animal right as it's pulled the trigger and not after it heard that, because I think those would have been even funnier.
But there are very few animals in the area.
Oh, they were, God, they took off. Yeah, they were terrified.
But it's a noble attempt. I mean, obviously, the idea is to get out of the way so that we're not interfering with this shot and see what things would look like.
Well, exactly, because animals, you know, they don't like us, really. They try to avoid it. They do everything they can to avoid us. And so camera traps are great because they can be remote and just sit out there. And nowadays, there's no giant explosions. You know, it's at most, it's usually a subtle infrared flash that they don't even see.
Well, and talk about that, because really it's been a long time since we needed magnesium cakes. But I'm wondering how well things advanced since then and whether or not the digital revolution has really changed things or whether, you know, I mean, obviously without, again, these giant explosions going off, maybe things were good.
Well, things actually moved very slow after that initial invention of the string and the camera, because cameras were still these giant things you had to carry out. They were, you know, it'd take your whole backpack to carry one of them. Once 35-millimeter film came along, and kind of in the 90s, you had these compact cameras, then camera trappers, scientists could run, you know, maybe a few dozen. But then you were still limited to this 36 roll of film. And that's where I sort of started in that day. And the digital cameras have revolutionized it now because you're not limited by the film, and we can even get some video, which is pretty cool. But it actually took us a while. We were probably the last group of photographers to adopt digital because the first number of generations just didn't work. One problem was just the moisture would kill the electronics. We're leaving them out in the woods in the rainforest, and they just didn't hold up. And the other thing was that if you remember the early digital cameras, when you'd push the shutter, it would take a few seconds for it to actually take a picture. And I had trouble getting pictures of my kids because they were always running around, and I'd push the button and they'd be gone before I could do that. And the same problem, you know, if you're trusting just for an animal to walk by, you need a very fast trigger. So it took a while before, you know, probably about 2008, 2010 was when the digital cameras started to really become useful for scientists. And those papers are now, you know, the things that we've learned over the last 5 or 6 years are a lot of what I covered in my book.
Well, I want to talk about that because we have had, even since 1913 and all the way through, some spectacular pictures of animals in the wild, albeit with photographers kind of setting up and taking these shots. What's different about the candid shots? What else can we learn?
Well, there's two things that are different. One is just that camera trappers get millions and millions of pictures. And so you're able to sort through, and, you know, for every one that's in my book, there's probably a million shots of the animal's butt, or they're really far away, or they're blurry, or whatever, whatever. So we've definitely, you know, that was one of the really fun parts about writing the book, is I would write to a scientist. You know, there's over 152 different research groups that have contributed pictures to the book, and each one of those is probably represented by a number of field assistants and all this. So I would write to them and say, hey, this is a cool research result you have. Do you have any pictures you could share? And they'd go to their greatest hits folder, and they'd send me some of their, you know, their top 10 or top 20, and then I'd go through and pick the top one or two that kind of made the cut.
And in the wild is in quotes as well. I mean, we're seeing a lot of animals coming in and out of culverts and you know, bypasses.
So the second great thing about why camera traps get such cool pictures is that they can get the species that are basically impossible to get otherwise. You know, you can be a photographer and sit out in a blind and wait for these animals to go by, but they're going to smell you, or you're going to fall asleep, or you're going to have to go to the bathroom or whatever. You know, these cameras just sit there just quietly and they record whatever animals walk by. So I tried in the book to show, you know, things like elephants and lions that everyone loves and knows, that we have some unique camera trap pictures, and we've still learned unique things about them from the camera trapping.
Tell us about that. What are some of the unique findings?
Well, each species is different. I mean, tigers have been the species that's probably been most studied. And basically, almost everything we know about where tigers are and how many there are, and just counting the animals, it comes from camera trapping these days, knowing which parks have them, which parks don't, how their populations are doing. And so the same can be said about a number of other species. And so the whole book is kind of about what we've learned about all these different species, some of these common animals, but also some rare ones like the dog mongoose or the ring-tailed vantsira or some of these other animals that you've probably never even heard of, that basically most of what we know comes from the few camera trap studies that have gotten their pictures.
It's interesting. And also, you've learned some things by setting up cameras kind of on either side of the trail. Tell us about the importance of that and being able to see the markings and all of that.
Yeah, sort of so for species you can identify by their patterns, and that's things like tigers, leopards, things that have spots or stripes. There's this whole extra bit of information because you know the individual animal. You know, you can recognize the stripe patterns, you can match them up, and you can give them names, and you can sort of track their fate over time, see how long they live, things like this. And so to do that the best, because the patterns aren't symmetrical right to left, so you need a picture of both sides to know that it's the same animal.
You do have some video, but most of these are still, certainly in the book, Candid Creatures, all stills. Again, what do you learn about an animal? I mean, I guess, you know, that it's there, and you may have wondered if it was there and how many. But can you learn anything about its behavior from a snapshot of an animal?
Yeah, sure, because it's the accumulation of behavior. So sometimes you can get one snapshot that's very telling. I've got a bunch of pictures in there of animals carrying prey. And that's a really impossible thing to see with your own eyes. But again, you get millions and millions of pictures and you see what the animals are eating. You see sometimes an animal following a porcupine. We've got another instance of a predator with a face full of porcupine quills. So you can kind of learn about things like that. But also it's the accumulation of these pictures over time. So it's seeing, well, what time of day are they active? What habitat are they using? Does one species avoid the habitat that's used by another species because maybe that's a predator? And so it's, you know, what the scientists do is we take these super fun, interesting pictures and the more boring ones, and we turn them into data, into zeros and ones and numbers, and we use those to answer research questions.
Well, and also the data that's in the book and just sort of the captions and some of the information. So there's a picture, for instance, I'm thinking of the coyote carrying a feral cat. And again, I think there's a culvert in that picture, so he's headed to some kind of drainage ditch. But what's interesting and what I didn't know is how important they are in the Southwest for sort of controlling the population of feral cats.
Yeah,
right?
The scientist who contributed that picture said that was basically his dissertation wrapped up in one photograph, because it was a coyote carrying a cat, so there was that side of things. And then it was also using this culvert to actually get under a road. And so it was trying to avoid getting hit by a car and sort of connecting up through these natural areas in that way.
Cool stuff. I love all the pictures. The only disturbing picture in the whole book is the Tasmanian devil. Because it doesn't look anything like the Warner Brothers cartoons. And I thought, well, where'd this guy come from? Because it can't be a Tasmanian devil, I know.
Well, it is a Tasmanian devil. And the remarkable thing about that is it's horribly disfigured, that photograph, which is gross and disturbing. But the reason is it has something called a facial cancer, which is one of two known contagious cancers. And it just hit the population in the last, dozen years or so. And it's had a devastating effect. And this is an example where just a photograph, you can tell that animal has this cancer or it doesn't, and they're passing it on to each other. And initially, there was fear that the whole species was going to go extinct from this. And now they found that actually through camera trapping and other efforts that they're starting to bounce back. They're starting to think maybe they're getting some immunity. They're seeing more animals that don't have the cancer. Yeah. And even what they call ground zero, the area that first got the facial cancer, was initially wiped out. And now the devils have actually come back.
Well, obviously leads to great speculation whether or not they're developing immunity, whether or not there was some environmental problem in the area that caused individuals to just get it spontaneously. How much about the genetics of that particular cancer do we know, and what can we learn if they have, in fact, developed immunities that might help us?
Yeah, well, that's a very active area of research, is trying to figure out, you know, what started this, because it, and how had it been in historic populations. I know there's some work going on, actually working with old museum specimens to try to see, look to see if they had the genetics of the disease on them from 100 years ago, which kind of shows the importance of having, you know, so these specimens, the camera traps are nice because they record, I call them voucher photographs, just like in museums, we have voucher specimens. We have old Tasmanian devils from 100 years ago, mm-hmm. and we can verify things with that. But it shows that both photographs and actual specimens are important to keep, to document, you know, what's the world like at one place at one time, and how do things change over time?
We, in one case, I guess you found an uneaten carcass in a tree and then set up a camera there. So the species can tell you where to set up, I guess.
Yeah. So different, that you can set cameras in 1,000 different ways, depending on what your research question is. In that case, hey, what's this carcass doing here? You know, very simple. I like the one just, hey, there's a funny hole in the ground. I wonder what lives in that. You know, that's a fun one. Actually, we're working with a student at NC State on that project here in North Carolina. Other times, you just want to use sort of a more rigorous approach of just randomizing cameras in an area just to see, all right, there's nothing special about this place, but I just want to know what animals are here and what animals are walking by. And cameras can get you that, because the animals generally don't avoid the camera trap. They don't even notice it. If they do notice it, they don't really mind it. And so it's a very non-invasive way to just document the world.
Though you have had instances of animals interacting with your cameras.
Yeah, they do often see them. And actually, my book has an overrepresentative sample of those, because those are the best pictures. When the animal's looking right at the camera, those are the ones that you grab and save and put in your greatest hits folder. And we've got examples. Elephants are notorious for destroying cameras, for stomping them with their feet or hitting with their tusks. Here in North Carolina, black bears are the biggest problem. Sometimes they go up and just chew on it. Other times they'll use it as a back scratch and kind of rub up and down on the tree. And then your camera's not broken, but it's all messed up. Yeah. I've had problems with spotted hyenas in Africa just destroy cameras. And we've got some pictures actually in the book of basically the inside of a jaguar's mouth that came up and sort of tasted the camera, but didn't bite down, so we were able to record the photograph of his tongue, which is kind of funny.
The elephants rebelling against the paparazzi. You can understand why.
Yeah,
they're
sure.
Hounded by them all the time. And yeah, these kind of orangutans with a duck face kind of doing a little selfie thing. But this does set up then possibilities, as we mentioned, for citizen science, the stuff right around our homes. You did some of that, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of citizen science projects going in Raleigh, and this is something we're going to be expanding next year across the whole state, because camera trapping's fun. It's not that complicated, and it's a way that non-experts can collect information that's actually really useful to us. And so we've been loaning out cameras or working with people who have their own camera traps, maybe for hunting or something like that, to set them sometimes in their backyard, sometimes in the local park, and record what the information is, and then share it through our eMammal research project. Give us the pictures back to us, send us a GPS coordinate, and we can use that for all sorts of research techniques. So a lot of my projects in the last years have been citizen science.
You set up a camera trap near your home. Tell us about what you found.
Yeah, so one of these what's in that hole questions. we were out with some NC State undergraduates setting some cameras. Initially, we were just sort of in the woods, and then we saw this remarkable hole, and then we realized, well, there's another one, and there's another one. There were three or four holes right there. So we set some camera traps up, and these were special cameras that actually text message me the picture. I only have a couple of those because they're more expensive, but it's fun because we actually use them for outreach. And 5 minutes later, we got a picture of a fox. So we had an active fox den, and those pictures last year, and we have it running right now, show the incredible drama of what's going on at a fox den with the sort of the raising the young and the breeding the food back by the parents and various predators that come by potentially threatening the puppies.
We've got some audio from that particular footage, and maybe you can describe it because it's a montage. We've got a couple of things going on. There are some babies involved in this, right? And
yeah.
I think we might hear them first. Is that what we're going to hear? Why don't we listen to it, and then you can come back and tell us, because we'll hear the voices, and even if we have to play it twice, play it once now, talk about it, and then play it again. Let's listen. Now, there's footage from a camera trap in Raleigh and the sounds of fox pups and the parents trying to lure a coyote away. You want to tell us again roughly what it is, and then we'll play it again. You can kind of do a running narration.
Yeah, sure. So the first couple sounds are instances of the puppies begging from the parents. And you can hear them kind of whining, and I think they're begging either to nurse or they want the parents to regurgitate. And I haven't seen that yet. I've seen them nursing. Mostly the parents have been bringing squirrels and rabbits in. There's been a lot of squirrels and a couple baby possums. So the first you're hearing that, and then there's this weird clacking sound, and I don't totally know what's going on there. This is one of the mysteries that we've kind of discovered, and I'm still trying to figure it out. And that's actually, if you look at the video, it's the pup is in the hole, and the parent is right down, they're face-to-face, and the pup is making that clacking sound. Mm. So I don't know if that's a kind of begging or if he's sort of complaining about what his brother was doing to him or what. And then the last case is one when a coyote had come to the hole. And the coyotes are, I don't know, last year we had the coyote actually steal a rabbit that the fox had brought. And this time we actually had the coyote trying to get into the hole. And he's too fat, luckily. so he isn't able to obviously get the puppies there. But as he's standing there, you can hear in the background, it's the fox barking. And I actually know for sure that's it because she barks at me sometimes when I go to change the battery.
It's interesting because it sounds a little bit like a bird, but you're saying that's a fox.
It's kind of an echoey of an echoey bark. And the coyote takes off. You can hear him running in the leaves. He actually takes off. I think he goes to chase her because coyotes will kill adult foxes as well. But I think she's doing that on purpose. I don't know if it's the mom or dad fox, but to lure the coyote away from the den.
All right, let's hear that again. So that's the begging.
Yeah, that's the begging. And there's the clacking that I don't really know what that is.
Mommy, he hit me back.
Yeah. And that's a little bark. Now, so that's the coyote barking in the background. And then you hear the fox barking and the coyote running away to chase her.
Well, this I guess also this brings up the question of, and these are some of the shots that you'll see, and many, many more in the book Candid Creatures, How Camera Traps Reveal the Mysteries of Nature. I'm talking to Roland Kays from the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Also, species, do we catch species interacting?
Yeah, sometimes you get two species on the camera at the same time. Often it's a predator killing something dead that is just caught. So we've seen in Raleigh, we've seen bobcats carrying foxes, bobcats carrying squirrels. We've seen some chases. So we've seen gray foxes chasing possums around. We've seen coyotes chasing deer. We've seen feral dogs chasing deer. And then around the world, you see all sorts of that kind of stuff. But the other way we do sometimes, as scientists, once we get the numbers, we look and say, hey, once a coyote went by, we didn't get another fox picture for 5 days. So we can tell, even if they're not there at the same time, we can tell that they're avoiding each other just by the patterns of when the photographs accumulate.
Now, does this set up the possibility of sort of permanent, you know, kind of like we have on the highways, we got the traffic cams, it's just always there? Is there any value in setting things up kind of permanently?
Well, sure. I think camera traps have this give us this opportunity to monitor change over time, to see if animal populations are going up or going down. And that's one of the things we're interested in doing with this statewide project that we're doing with the Wildlife Resources Commission in the upcoming year, to get citizens involved across the state to look to see, you know, how do things vary east to west, and then what happens from year to year to monitor our wildlife population. So not necessarily, you know, a fixed camera in the same place all the time, but sort of regularly putting cameras out in different places.
And you're going to be on Science Friday this week, so you'll be on the radio again.
Yeah.
For our public radio listeners.
Yeah, it's exciting. Talking more about camera trapping.
Well, that's very cool. So what was the biggest surprise for you in these photos so far? I know there's plenty more ahead, but what's the biggest surprise so far?
Well, I mean, every sort of study ends up finding something interesting and surprising. I think, you know, in the book, the getting these pictures from all the different people, the pictures that kind of got me the most engaged were the chimpanzees. Because I've never worked in areas that had chimpanzees myself, so I'd never seen this kind of thing. And whenever I'd go through those clips, you would see the chimpanzees almost always notice a camera. And they really huddled around. And a lot of times you'd see a whole family of them. And they're so cool because their faces are all different. You know, they look like a family of humans that have different faces. Some of them have these weird goofy ears, and others look like they have some bad skin or something. You know, it's like they look like an American family with little Harry. And they're all sort of crowded around and really looking interestedly at the camera.
Waiting for their 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Roland Kays. Hayes, as always, the director of the Biodiversity Lab at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Science. It's so good to know that diversity is celebrated somewhere on Jones Street. Yeah. Thank you for that. The new book called Candid Creatures, and we've got pictures at our website, stateofthings.org, and all the information about the book and the animals that we've just talked about. Just ahead, we're going to talk to an author whose debut novel is the result of a haunting image he just couldn't shake. Stay tuned.
There's a rumor, laughter's on its way. Smile, you're